You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
His abusive use of missiles and his nuclear threats show that he is begging for war. War is never something the United States wants. We don't want it now. But our country's patience is not unlimited.
World reacts to North Korea's latest nuclear test, much as North Korea would have expected. So what does North Korea really want? My guests Carol Walker and Michael Binion will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including US President Donald Trump's latest big idea, which won't happen and won't work if it does, the latest on Brexit negotiations, which couldn't be going much worse if Donald Trump had taken personal charge of them, and the demise of a Cambodian newspaper, and the possible demise of what remains of Cambodian democracy. Democracy along with it. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Carol Walker, former BBC correspondent, and Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist at The Times. Welcome both, and we start in Washington, D.C., and what appears set to be this week's pointless, unworkable, mean-spirited initiative, which will accomplish little but the avoidable bestirring of controversy and resentment from the desk of President Donald Trump. Tomorrow, President Trump will announce a decision on DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which aims to spare the obviously blameless children of illegal immigrants their worries about deportation and to provide them with opportunities to progress in the United States. Carol, first of all, reports suggest that Trump is either going to dump it completely or find a way to restrict it or do something to it, but, I quote, may change his mind. So basically anything could happen, which is, I'm sure, exactly what he wants us to think. So everybody will tune in for the big announcement. What do we think he's actually going to do?
Well, the suggestions seem to be that he's going to scrap this program, which essentially allowed people who were brought into the country illegally when they were still children to work and to stay. This was an initiative which President Obama introduced. It was back in 2012. So far, there have been 787,000 people have been approved for work under the scheme. And the suggestion is that he's going to scrap it, but he's going to give Congress 6 months to find a longer term solution. But when I said again, that is because he has been all over the place on this, as on so many issues. During his election campaign, he was talking about how he was going to get rid of all the illegal immigrants in the country, including perhaps these children. When it was then pointed out that many of these were people who literally came here without being aware, of course, of what was happening to them, didn't have any choice, and are now working very hard and contributing to the economy, he said, quotes, "I love the dreamers." He then said he was going to find a solution and deal with it with heart. But there now seems to be a big question mark about what's going to happen to all of these people who were brought here when they were just children, into the United States when they were just children.
Michael, as Carol sums it up there, he has suggested that, Trump has suggested that he's going to give Congress 6 months to come up with something else. This is all sounding faintly evocative, is it not, of his brilliant scheme for abolishing and replacing, or repealing and replacing, as the phrase was, Obamacare. Do we anticipate a similar process by which Congress failed to come up with anything that actually works? They put hundreds of thousands of people who rely on a particular government program through endless amounts of needless heartache and anguish, at the end of which nothing actually happens.
Yes, I think your neutral and impartial summing up is...
it's just that at this point, Michael, patterns are emerging in this presidency.
Yes, they are. And I think this is exactly the pattern we saw before with the healthcare bill. And the point is that that doesn't particularly worry Trump, because he can always turn around to say to his supporters, if they're going to start grumbling and complaining, "Look, I tried. I did what I could. It's Congress that's holding it up. I've thrown it over to them. They've screwed up, as always. They're the ones you want to blame." And that doesn't worry him at all, because he has enemies in Congress. He doesn't really mind upsetting them in the slightest. They feel they are not beholden to him, so we're set for a fight there anyway. And I don't think Congress will come up with anything else, because most all Democrats will oppose this idea and quite a few Republicans, so it simply won't get through.
I mean, that is what he's running up against, isn't it, Carol? The fact that pretty much everybody hates this idea, not just Democrats, as Michael points out, a great many Republicans, even Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who has swallowed his pride a great deal during the months of Trump's presidency, has come flat out and said that, you know, he doesn't want it scrapped.
And indeed, there's been a lot of public pressure as well. People like the Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, Apple chief executive Tim Cook, they've all come out and said, look, hundreds of our staff were dreamers. These are people who have worked hard to establish themselves in this country, that have very much assimilated the American culture, that are contributing to the local economy. So a lot of key opinion formers too are trying to say, look, these are not the illegal immigrants who are streaming over the border, who President Trump wants to build a wall to stop. These are people who are, in many cases, central to local communities, contributing to many local communities. And I think the idea of scrapping it is going to run into huge opposition. And I think the danger for Trump is that even if he tries to blame it all on Congress, if he is seen to be turning his back on people who are genuinely trying to live the American dream, then I think that could reflect pretty badly on him. Although until now, despite all the ups and downs, it's extraordinary how much his public ratings have held up.
Well, which does prompt my next question, Michael, which is that do we imagine that President Trump actually really cares in the slightest one way or the other about the so-called dreamers, these children of illegal immigrants, or does he just see this way a way of throwing a bone to his base, this being that apparently irreducible 34% of Americans who still approve of him, and the startling figure which always comes up to me, the 61% of Trump voters who say there is literally nothing he could do that would cause them to change their minds about him.
That's right. Yes, I think he is throwing them a bone. I mean, he doesn't care about any issue at all except the issue of maintaining support and being seen to be a great guy in the eyes of those who elected him. Now, whatever he does, some will always think he's a great guy. Some will be disappointed. Some will grumble. But the diehard supporters, they need the occasional bone. He's throwing this to them, or at least he's appearing to throw them something, even if he doesn't follow through on it. And I think that's the thing. I don't think he can follow through because of such widespread opposition. And, of course, it puts the Republicans in a real dilemma because, on the one hand, they do want to respond to what they think is grassroots feeling about immigration. On the other hand, the practicalities and realities of it, as with healthcare, are that in their own individual constituencies, these are the congressional Republicans, there are a lot of people who are going to object if they take a Trump line.
Just a final thought on this, Carol. It is, of course, easy for us to say, because none of us are the children of illegal immigrants to the United States, having to worry about the prospect of being deported back to a country we may never actually have even visited. But how actually worried should people in that position be? Is anything going to come of this?
Well, I think that you're looking at people here who are already probably pretty worried, because even if they were children when they came into the country, it's quite possible that their parents were initially illegal immigrants who may have found ways of staying in the country, who may have managed to find job, may have managed to find work. The rhetoric that they have faced ever since Donald Trump's election campaign and his election is enough to unsettle anyone living in those communities. If you know that you are in the country illegally, of course you're going to be worried. Of course you are going to be concerned. It may well be of some comfort if you've got lots of opinion formers saying to Donald Trump, saying, come on, show some heart like you promised. Think about these people who want to live here in the United States, want to contribute, most of whom are making a big contribution to society. But if you're one of those people who's been subjected to this barrage of hardline rhetoric from Donald Trump, of course you're going to be really worried, and of course you're going to fear what's going to happen to you, and in many cases, your own families who you maybe have brought up in the United States. States.
Well, let's move along now, because President Trump also has, alongside every other national leader with an interest in Southeast Asia, an ever less ignorable problem in the shape of North Korea. North Korea tested another nuclear weapon yesterday, its biggest to date, and reports suggest the country is preparing further missile tests with a view to demonstrating a viable nuclear ICBM capacity. South Korea has carried out more live fire exercises today. The UN Security Council has convened an emergency meeting. Michael, I could have predicted that that would be the global response to another North Korean nuclear test. So I'm pretty sure the North Koreans saw all this coming. So if they've already factored in that there would be more live fire exercises by South Korea, UN Security Council emergency meeting, there will have to be at the very least an increased, either actually increased sanctions or the appearance of increased sanctions. They knew all that was coming. What do they actually want?
They basically want to be left alone to be, well, the regime wants, or rather Kim Jong-un wants to be absolutely unchallengeable at home. And the only way he's going to do that is to so terrify his own people, his own generals, his own entourage, that there's no possible challenge to his power from any source. And the way he feels he can do that is to make North Korea into an ever more paranoid state, seemingly threatened, and in this case really threatened by its neighbours because of his behaviour, to the point where he can then dictate some possible compromise if he chooses. Now, the compromise would clearly be a massive amount of aid, some kind of, I won't say end to his isolation, but something where trade flows freely.
But he doesn't want an end to his isolation,
no, he
does he?
Really.
Because an end to what North Korea's isolation destroys the regime.
Well, it does, yes. I mean, you're right. And so one does wonder. I mean, I think it's only the survival of himself that he really wants. I mean, I can't see what else he would want. You're right, he's factored in everything. The only thing he cannot really factor in is China. And he does think that the Chinese will never, never agree to an embargo that is so strong that it brings down his regime. That is his bottom line, and he thinks that's the Chinese bottom line. Therefore, he's safe.
Is he, though, Carol? Are we approaching the point at which China, and the conventional wisdom is that what China does not want is a United States satellite South Korea board, or a unified Korea, which is also a US satellite state, directly bordering it. It does seem to me, in an increasingly globalized world, that matters less and less and less. China cannot possibly perceive a unified Korea as a strategic threat. I mean, China is China. It's enormous. But are we approaching the point at which China might decide, if they've got to pick one of those, frankly, they'd rather have a unified Korea, which may be capitalist and democratic, but won't be run by a madman with nuclear weapons?
Well, I think what you've got to remember is that China has been making efforts to make overtures to the West to try to improve links, for example, with the UK and with other European states, to show that it's not a closed society, to build bridges in that extent. And it's going to have to weigh those efforts and those ambitions against those historic concerns about what a unified Korea might mean. Now, China has been saying very forcefully that using force to resolve this issue on the Korean Peninsula is not an option. It wants, above all, to try to prevent any kind of conflict there. But I think what is really interesting now is this threat that we've had from Donald Trump, one of his latest tweets, is that he's going to stop all trade with any country doing trade with North Korea.
Well, that's,
now, of
that's
course,
just...
the, of course, the biggest country doing trade with North Korea is China.
Which is also the biggest country doing trade with the United States.
Exactly. So is Donald Trump really prepared to risk an all-out trade war with China in order to try to force it to bring North Korea into the fold? I think the wider difficulty when you stand back from all this is the simple fact that you have got two unpredictable, very powerful people, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, and the rhetoric is showing no sign of calming down. And you've actually got North Korea now testing these, what everyone seems to agree is a hydrogen bomb. And I think that the simple combination of those two factors is overriding all these other concerns.
Michael, as far as we know, and as far as anyone seems to know, and there appears to be a great big sucking void at the heart of all discussions about this, but are there any military options which aren't potentially just completely hideous?
The only military options are clandestine ones, assassination or targeting him from inside. That's the only likely and possible way, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if there are quite a number of operations already going on. North Korea is notoriously hard to predict. It's hard to find out what goes on, and it's almost impenetrable, but not completely, I would have thought. I mean, no country is absolutely impenetrable in terms of getting agents on the ground, making contact with disaffected people. And that might be a Chinese option as well. They would feel that a military option by the United States would be so catastrophic and so wrong that they're not going to allow it. But if they are really worried by Kim Jong-un, they need to destabilize the regime from inside.
Carol, is it possible that that's where Trump is going with this? I mean, the tweet you quoted about the idea of ceasing America's trade with all countries, I mean, is just obviously idiotic and unworkable in and of itself. It couldn't possibly happen. And I may be crediting him with a scad too much tactical acuity here, but is it possible that he is trying to signal that he expects China to solve this problem?
I think part of the problem is that the United States, in terms of the amount of intelligence, the amount of penetration that it's got into North Korea because of the regime that has been in power there, is pretty minimal. It has not been a priority for US intelligence or for any other Western intelligence. So I think if there is going to be some sort of operation of the type that Michael has talked about, that would have to come from the Chinese. And you do wonder what is being said in the back channels between these two countries, because neither of them would actually want to go into a trade war. Neither of them would want this issue to end China's attempts to reach out to the West, to open itself up and open up new markets for its goods. So you do wonder whether behind the scenes there are these sorts of signals being sent out. But I think it's pretty clear that the United States would have to be reliant on somebody like the Chinese, because as far as I am aware, the American intelligence agencies simply do not have the sort of penetration that they would have in other parts of the world to try to carry out the sort of operation that Michael's been talking about.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Carol Walker and Michael Binion. Coming up next, hard Brexit, soft Brexit or dog's Brexit?
Are you looking to strike a better work-life balance? If so, then the shiny new September issue of Monocle magazine is just what the doctor ordered. Join Monocle's business team as they head for the most agreeable third-tier cities. Moving advice for those on the hunt for a new live-work base. Breathe in, breathe out, and discover why third-tier definitely doesn't mean third-class. Step into the office of some select founders and CEOs to see exactly how they go about their work, from illustrator Christoph Niemann to legendary designer Dries Van Noten. And there's more. Hear from the first female Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, illuminating views on Geneva's neon scene, a walk through the transformative architecture of Jakarta, and savour the sight of Sweden's garden restaurants brought to delicious life on the page. That's all in the September issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now, or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Carol Walker and Michael Binion. Let's look now at the UK, which has known for more than a year that it is leaving the EU, has known for some months when it is leaving the EU, but appears none the wiser how or on what terms. Following another round of inconclusive talks last week, the UK's government has this week made the unsurprising declaration that it is ready to intensify discussions. British MPs will shortly begin debating the EU withdrawal bill, which seems unlikely to be a process characterised by seamless consensus. Michael, leaving aside the rights and wrongs of Brexit, whether people are for it or against it, is there out there a general narrative taking root that this process has degenerated somewhat into shambles?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it I wouldn't say it was ever less than a shambles. I mean, it never generated in the first place, as it were. Yes. I mean, also, what is extraordinary is the nonchalant pace at which this has been pursued. I mean, I didn't realise that they're only meeting once a week every month. Well, I remember...
We won't be able to use words like nonchalant after March 2019.
No, well, then shall we say the lackadaisical pace.
And they're pretty short weeks, only 4 days, actually.
Only 4 days. I remember the actual negotiating process to enter the EU when Ted Heath, later Prime Minister, was Britain's negotiator. That was virtually round the clock all the time. He came back occasionally for consultations with London, but he was in there, in Brussels, getting this going day and night till he got it. Well, if we're determined to leave, you know, and this time we have a deadline approaching, so we know we've got to leave by a certain time, I cannot believe that they should be so kind of unbothered about how things are going. It makes perfect sense to step up the pace, but it also, of course, is difficult to step up the pace unless you already agreed beforehand with your own home government what it is you're trying to achieve.
Carol, I think we've reached that point in the programme at which we can indulge a spot of baseless speculation. We've seen a somewhat gnomic utterance from EU panjandrum Guy Verhofstadt today that the UK government has asked for the next round of talks to be put back a week to the last week of September because Theresa May, the Prime Minister, is making, and I quote, an important intervention on September 21st. Do we have any idea what this could be?
Well, we do know that Theresa May has been planning a big speech on Europe this autumn. The date has not yet been confirmed. You would think that she would have to make it before her annual party conference when the Conservative Party gathers. That is the first week in October. So the suggestion is that this intervention could come on the 21st of September. The big question is, what is she going to say? She has been insisting that the government's policy is based on a speech that she made earlier in the year when she said that Britain was going to leave the European single market, it's going to leave the customs union, and it's going to end the remit of the European Court of Justice in Britain. Now, since then, the pace of these discussions has been glacial. A lot of people have been pointing out that, for example, ending the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice causes all sorts of problems, because if you're not going to have the ECJ overseeing any disputes, what does that mean for Britain's membership of all kinds of things like the nuclear agency Euratom? What does it mean for when there are disputes about the rights of EU workers on a whole host of different issues? That is now being held up as a really big problem. So if the talks are delayed for a week, well, we've had 5 or 6 months of virtually no momentum so far. So another week's not going to make much difference if she has something new and significant to say. I should say there was a wonderful line today from one of the critics of this process, Nick Clegg, the former Lib Dem leader, who said, well, when the UK negotiator David Davis talks about progress, it's a bit like when the workers stand on the building site and they say, well, there's a bit of progress, when actually all that's happened is that they've made the tea.
I think any journalist with a deadline approaching knows that feeling very, very well. But Michael, what do you get the sense is going on here among the Brexiteers? Did they either massively underestimate how difficult and complex this would be, or did they just think they weren't going to win so they wouldn't have to worry about it?
Both, I think. They thought they weren't going to win, so they didn't estimate in advance what the process would entail. Rather casually waved aside all the objections that were put forward by so-called experts, saying who needs experts, every single one of which has proved true. And they probably...
It's almost like these expertise have some sort... Experts rather have some sort of expertise.
Well, that's quite astonishing, yes. Since then, I think they've been making it up as they go, trying to work out, you know, well, what could we do and what should we do? And I think in the background, there's been some quite cautious backpedalling without being seen to do so. I mean, David Davis, the chief negotiator, has made a number of statements which suggests, A, that Britain is ready to pay a certain amount into the European Union in order, the sum for leaving. We haven't got the figures, but He's sort of accepted that in principle. He's also accepted a transitional arrangement. He's begun to accept the kind of things that are becoming a bit more both real and possible. But the big picture of how we get there and how we get to any agreement in time is simply not there.
It's going to be very strange, Carol, just a final thought on this, watching the Brexiteer wing of the Tory party trying to come up with something they think they can sell to Brexiteer voters, isn't it, in terms of both a final settlement and a transition period.
And I think
these are not people renowned for their patience.
And I think that the way they have been pursuing this is going to make it very difficult indeed for them to back down significantly at this stage. But I think it is worth saying that this is not just a domestic British problem. I think that the problems are in part by the UK government's handling, but the European Union has been pretty intransigent. There is a problem in the whole structure of these talks. David Davis has some logic when he points out, for example, we can't settle these questions over the Irish border because after Brexit, Northern Ireland will be outside the EU. The Irish Republic will be within it. He is saying you can't sort out problems like that until we know what the future trading arrangement is going to be, until we know what sort of customs deal there is going to be. Michel Barnier, on behalf of the EU, is insisting we simply cannot talk about this future trading relationship until we've had enough progress on things like the Irish border, the status of EU citizens in the UK and so on. So there is a real problem with the structure of these talks. And I think unless and until both sides face up to the reality that as things go on, they're heading for no deal at all, it's very difficult to see where the breakthrough is going to come. But maybe that will come with the Prime Minister's speech in September.
OK, well, finally tonight, it does look like the world of newspapers will have to bid a regretful valet to the Cambodia Daily. The independent English language newspaper has announced its closure after the presentation of a tax bill for the equivalent of $6.3 million. There are those cynical souls who suspect that this is not unrelated to the paper's criticisms of Cambodia's interminably serving Prime Minister Hun Sen or the fact that prominent opposition leader Kem Sokha was arrested over the weekend. Michael, I'm going to go ahead and assume that the tax bill is rather an excuse rather than the reason for the government's action. What, from the point of view of the government of a country like Cambodia, why wail on an English language newspaper which sells a few thousand copies?
Well, that's a very interesting question. There are quite a lot of English language newspapers in countries around the world that are read only by a small elite, namely either expatriates or a few people who understand English. And they have usually had quite a lot of license to say more than their own domestic press. I'm thinking particularly of the Moscow Times, an English language paper, which has been quite brave and quite outspoken and has said things that haven't appeared in the Russian press, partly as a sort of small safety valve so that intellectuals can sort of feel, yes, well, there is a way of finding out things, partly because most the rulers think, well, it doesn't matter. Nobody who really matters reads this. Now, in Cambodia, I think it's not quite the same. I think this the number of people who can and do read English is quite large. And I think the influence of this small newspaper on other journalists there is also quite large. So they see this as very much a spearhead of sort of non-government controlled press and therefore possibly destabilizing. And at a time when, as you say, they are cracking down generally, this is the obvious place to start.
Carol, when a Prime Minister like Hun Sen, who has been in power for 30-odd years, does something like this, he knows how it will be perceived, certainly overseas, and I'm sure he has factored that in. Should we assume that this is therefore a manoeuvre he's made more for domestic consumption?
Well, you do wonder whether he's one of those leaders who's been in power so long that he's got a bit of a bunker mentality. It does tend to happen that when people have been in power for a considerable amount of time, they find it harder and harder to accept criticism of anything that they do. There is a terrible irony in this, that this newspaper, which was founded back in 1993, which seems to have been a real beacon of proper independent reporting in the country, even as their reporters knew that they were going to be sacked and lose their jobs and the whole thing was going to be closed down, they rushed over the weekend to report on the arrest of the main opposition leader. It does seem to be part of a wider crackdown. And clearly, I think that the country will now face a lot of criticism from the outside world for its attitude.
Well, we'll have more on that story on tonight's Monocle Daily, but that brings us to the end of today's show. Carol Walker and Michael Binion, thanks both very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Miriana Lagrasta and Maddie Speed. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next. 1900, Rob Bound is in with Culture. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.